There are a number of examples in the Bible that I wonder about from time to time. I don't wonder in the sense that I question if they actually occurred. What I wonder about is me. I wonder if in those circumstances, if I could do what some other of God's servants have done. I wonder whether even with God's Spirit, if I could do certain specific things. Some of the stories to me are just so incredible. I can understand Samson dying in the temple of Dagon. You know, he's there, humiliated, his eyes are poked out, God gives him back his strength, and he's standing there between the pillars. I can understand Samson giving a great heave and push, crying out to God, and bringing the temple down on his own head, and taking out the Philistine lords in the process. You know, if I had long hair, I think I could do that. I think I can understand Daniel continuing to pray openly after Darius's decree. Now, maybe if I was in his shoes, I would have at least closed the shutters, or I might have prayed quietly, but I can understand that that was Daniel's custom, that was his relationship to God, and it caused him to be thrown in the lion's den. But I can understand that he continued to do what it was that he had committed himself to. Some of the things that I wonder about, again, mainly wondering about myself, was when I see Christ dying on, you know, the stake and the crucifixion, and in the midst of his agony, he cries out and he says, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." I seriously wonder if even with a pouring out of God's Spirit, if I would ever measure up to a standard such as that. And it's not just Christ, it was Stephen when he was dying, being murdered, and he cried out basically the same thing, "Lord, do not charge them with this sin." There's another example in the Bible that I look at and ponder, and it's when Abraham willingly, in obedience to God, offered his son Isaac, or was ready to, raise the knife and sacrifice. And I just said, what does it take to obey God to that degree, to be willing to go to that degree? Now, I know Paul suffered many things, and it was Paul who recorded in Philippians that he can do all things through Christ, who strengthens him. And Paul seemed indeed to be able to do all things through Christ. Paul died a martyr's death. He suffered and was beaten and humiliated, and sometimes he literally got back up and walked back into the city to where he had been cast out. Now, those are incredible things. What some of God's servants have done by the power of His Spirit is remarkable, but I still wonder sometimes about me. I don't think I'm really afraid to die, and I don't think I'm afraid to... Well, I know I'm not afraid of guns. I've never quite understood why I'm not afraid of guns, but I found out that I just wasn't afraid of guns. You could point a gun at me, and it didn't really bother me that much. Just don't punch me in the nose. My nose is very tender, and I never wanted to be punched in the nose. But it never bothered me to stand up and face a gun. It's just the way my brain, I guess, is built, or maybe not built, whichever way that would be. Last week, Frank and Judy went down. We all went down to Kennewick together. And you would have heard his sermonette, so therefore you would know he's there unless you got stuck in traffic on the freeway from the accident, and some of you did actually not make it in very quickly to church because of the traffic jam from the accident on the freeway. But on the way down in the car, Frank was describing a particular struggle that he had gone through, and he described how it was resolved. And without giving you exactly his words, because I've taken some of what he said and I've chewed on that through this week as circumstances have played out in the congregation. And what I would say, he said, in the process of this trial, he came to a better understanding of God. He came to know God in a more specific way and some of what the character and natural traits of God are, and that gave him peace. So I began to kind of chew on that in my own mind. Barbara Hoover had surgery for cancer. Got a notice later this week that she had had a bit of a relapse on her recovery from that. Her heart was racing. She was not doing well. I tried to get a final update this morning. I had a note come in last night that your prayers are requested for Barbara Hoover. Wes is obviously very concerned, and she has not been recovering well from the surgery that she had. Spent part of the week up with Tom and Linda Kersey, and an announcement was made on that last week. She has cancer. She has cancer in a very serious circumstance. She's been fighting it for over 5 years. You know, they're now members of our congregation here, even though they're at Sandpoint. They have visited coming and going, but they've moved and they're here. But because of her health failing so drastically at that same critical time, it's not like we're in contact fully. And so yesterday I went up with Grace, and then Sunday Frieda and Grace are going up, and we're trying to assist in various ways with the family. But here again is another crisis and a trial. And so I began to ponder, indeed, what is it that gives us strength and peace? What is it that gives us courage instead of despair? And I kept going back to some of the comments that Frank had been chewing over in his own circumstance and what he had walked through. And I want to illustrate some issues today that I think we base our faith on in knowing God in a better way. The first of those points is that God is perfect in his power. God has to have the power and the authority to rule, or there is nothing, from no basis from which he can exercise, again, the decisions that he makes. God is perfect in his power. We need to understand that God has all power and that it is perfect, that there are no flaws in it, there's no weakness or shortness of what his abilities are. I want to show you how he worked with Israel coming out of Egypt. In Exodus 19, I'd like to show you in verse number 4 the illustration here. This is essentially the proposal for the covenant, the old covenant that he would make with them at Sinai. But notice what he says in verse number 4. He says, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians." What did he do to the Egyptians? He annihilated the whole nation. You could say that God reasoned with the Egyptians because there was a certain amount of reasoning. He attacked their gods that they worshipped, and therefore he attacked the power of Satan that supported their religious system. But basically, God just came through and annihilated the nation piece by piece by piece and took them down. So he says, "You've seen what I did to the Egyptians." He exercised his power in an absolutely dramatic way. "And how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So he's talking here to Moses to talk to the people and to say, "Tell them of my power. Remind them of the way that I interceded in bringing them out here before me." Now go to back in chapter 14, and notice now, as they were getting ready to cross the Red Sea, again, you have this, Satan exercises his power, and God exercises his, and it's a contest for Israel to see the power of God. It was told, verse 5, chapter 14, the king of Egypt, that the people had fled, and that the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, "Why have we done this? Why have we let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. He took 600 choice chariots, and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. Have you ever watched the movies where the soldiers all line up facing each other? I don't know why my mind keeps going back to the Battle of Waterloo as it was written about, and I read it, and I imagine Napoleon. I've mentioned it before, but I go back to this view of Napoleon with his troops lined up and his artillery and the soldiers lined up on the other side and the conditions, and I just think, I just can't hardly believe it. These people just run at each other. Or they ride their horses right into the front line. Or you go back to battles in the Civil War. And here you have this large army forming up out of Egypt. Somehow they scrapped it back together. God allowed this to remain in a functional unit. All these chariots. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. So they were not afraid to begin. It was exciting. They saw God's power and deliverance. But then they saw the Egyptian army, Satan's power. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. And so they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you, saying that let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians, or forever? The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. He says God will fight the battle, and so you have God's power, you have Satan's power, and Moses said, look at the power of God and ignore those chariots. God will take care of those things. It's perfect. If you're keeping up, and I hope we all are, with the Bible reading, I had some remarkable treatise, an explanation of God's power. Look at Job 38. I went back and I reread this section, and you know, it is just the notes from the Bible reading program just absolutely brought this back to me to life. Job is struggling, he's full of sores, and he's uncomfortable, and he's lost his family, and he's lost his possessions, and basically God says, don't you know how powerful I am? Don't you know what I'm able to do? As if somehow God let Job slip through his fingers. Or something happened that God missed. Oops, Job, I wasn't on duty this morning. God says, that's not the way it is. I'm perfect in my power. Job 38, verse number 4. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line on it? Did it? Finished the beer anyway. Just to be safe. And I never thought anything about it. Then I heard this earthquake. I thought, you know, that's amazing. You know, now, think about that. There's an earthquake in Montana. How hard would you have to push on the rocks in Montana to wiggle the rocks, Spokane? Believable. So measurement, surely you know. So what were its foundations fastened, or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Who shut the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? You know, all that water and the depths of the God just, you know, put it into play. He restrained it where he chose. When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come but no further, and here your proud waves must stop. God put the gold in California, and he didn't intend it to be underwater. And he said, the ocean will come to here, this is land, and this is what I'm going to open in my treasure when the time comes so that this land can be settled according to my purpose. All those things God laid out, and it just, again, it is an incredible statement of his power. Verse 16, have you entered the springs of the sea? Have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of hell been revealed to you deep down in the grave, so to speak? Have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Again, just dramatic. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? Darkness, where is its place that you may take it to its territory? That you may know the paths to its home? Do you know it because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? Have you entered the treasury of snow? People say, well, where did all the water come from Noah's flood in that day? It came from the treasury of water. I don't know where that is. I don't know, it was under the earth and pushed down, or everything went flat and rolled over the top, or if God just made a bunch of water and dumped it down. I mean, who knows? But God is saying you can do those things. He kind of stores it all up in his way and releases it when it's ready. Have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? By what way is light diffused? So what is it? Is light a particle, or is it a wave? Or is it a particle wave? What in the world is light? You know that man doesn't have a clue what gravity is? I mean, we know it sticks us to the earth, but doesn't have any idea what gravity is. God created it, and man only can observe that it exists. Or the east wind scattered over the earth. How come in the wind rivers the wind can blow 30, 40 miles an hour and there are still mosquitoes when it stops? Only God knows. Where do the mosquitoes go when the wind stops and they come back out and there's a billion of them and you were sure they all got blown? Maybe the ones from next door are blown into where we were camped. But, you know, it's one of those questions. Where, in fact, why are there mosquitoes? Chapter 41 is where fire-breathing dragons and sea monsters come from. I know I've read this in the past, but until I went through in the Bible reading program, it really didn't bring it to life in that same way. Look at verse 14, chapter 41. Talking about Leviathan here. It's either, as it is portrayed, a great sea monster, like Loch Ness Monster. You know, they're kind of cutesy, and they have one that's the old, what is it, the guy up in the Kelowna? Ogopogo? He's from the 60s. Rides a, oh, we'll forget it. And weak attempted humor. But here we have, he's described also in that sense as a fire-breathing dragon. And so you go, well, when you picture all these cute little dragons, you know, that fly around in the movies and stuff, that's Satan. And they make them cute, and they befriend them. And but that's where the analogy comes from. Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. Some have argued there's literal dinosaur-type creatures. And others have said, well, it's strictly an analogy. But regardless, notice what God is portraying. God is saying, I have the power of dominion. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They're joined one to another. They stick together and cannot be parted. His sneezing flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids in the morning. Out of his mouth go burning light. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out his nostrils. That's where, again, fire-breathing dragons come from. It's from Job 41. It goes on down, though, and it begins to describe his power and how God has dominion. In verse 34, he beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. Who is the king over the children of pride? It is Satan. So again, you have a description of Satan's power, and God says, I am in charge. I have power. I have dominion. I believe knowing and recognizing God's power and dominion is very important for us in building our faith and strength and courage and obedience to God. If we go back to Exodus 19, you know, when God spoke to Israel, he spoke to them in a very dramatic way. Verse number 10. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and sanctify them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothes and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And did he come down in that sense to reason with them, to speak softly to them? But he came down in a show of power. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourself that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. And he goes down again, describes this. Verse 15, he said to the people, be ready for the third day. Do not come near your wives. It came to pass on the third day in the morning that there was thundering and lightning and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud so that the people who were in the camp trembled. Again, going back to this account in Exodus, God is showing I am perfect in my power. That was not supposed to be a threat to the people to weaken their faith. That was supposed to strengthen their faith because God says, I am on your side. I will be your God and you will be my people. You will be to me a kingdom, a very special people, and I have power. So I think the first step for us in our courage and our strength is to recognize that God is perfect in his power. I think the next step is that God is perfect in his knowledge. He has power, but he also has all knowledge. He knows everything that there is to know. Sometimes I've heard individuals argue that God knows things that don't exist yet, and that's hard for me to believe. I've always had to phrase it that God knows everything there is to know. He can bring to pass that which he chooses, but he doesn't know things that don't exist because they haven't even happened. Hebrews 4 and verse number 12. This describes God's word and how it applies, but what its purpose it also provides. The word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of the soul and spirit and of joints and marrow. He says it cuts right down into the midst of us, into the deepest recess. It's an analogy of what would be in our heart and mind, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. God knows everything. Now again, that should not be a threat to us. That should be a comfort. The comfort is that no one has ever been misunderstood by God. In your marriage, have you ever had a misunderstanding with your mate? I know, that would be very unusual. Have you ever had a misunderstanding with your friend or the pastor or someone who works for you or someone you work for instead? It doesn't matter. We've had all kinds of misunderstandings. And there are times when we feel like we've not been understood and not been carefully treated or not been, you know, responsibly cared for in one way or another or responded to. No one has ever been misunderstood by God. God knows our frame. And he knows our circumstance. Psalm 103 is something I read fairly recently, but Psalm 103 in verse number 11, again, I think should give us comfort. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward those who fear him. Why do they fear him? Because he has power. So power is the basis, but then comes a different step. God is perfect also in his understanding. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. As a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. He knows our circumstance. He knows our weakness, and he knows our strength. As for man, his days are like grass, as a flower of the field, so he flourishes. For the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and its place remembers it no more. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, who recognize his power, and his righteousness to children's children, to such as keep his covenant, and to those who remember his commandments to do them. So it's not as if we don't have a responsiveness to God that God would require of us, but it should give us comfort that he knows our frame. He knows our thoughts. He knows what we did yesterday and when we repented last night. He knows that we woke up and we yearned to be in church, or we yearned to teach, or we yearned to be taught, whatever our circumstance at any individual time might be. When we were working on the index before I left, and we were working on encouragement, one of the scriptures we put in under encouragement was Romans 8:28. I'd like to go to Romans 8, but start at verse 27, just a little bit before. Because it ties in. One second here, I lost the book of Romans. Romans 8. It ties in with God's knowledge. and how that should impact us and what that should cause us to do in terms of knowledge as well. Romans 8, verse 27. He who searches the heart knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. We know that God will work on our behalf in this life because he has called us into his service. And how do we know that? Since for he foreknew, he knew in advance what his plan was going to be, and that he would call us, and that we would serve him, and that he would then carry through to the end. For whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he predestined, these he also called. Whom he called, he also justified. Whom he justified, he also glorified. So it does, it looks forward to a little larger scale in terms of time, but it is an encouraging statement. Verse 31. What then shall we say to these things? If we know, we have knowledge that God will work with us and intercede for us because God has purposed and made this part of his plan, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own Son but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? God has perfect knowledge. Who can bring an accusation against God's elect to God when God has perfect knowledge? Because he cannot be deceived, and he's never misunderstood any human being. It is God who justifies. It is God who makes us right by the blood of Jesus Christ. Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who makes intercession for us. He makes intercession for us because he knows our frame and he knows that we are dust, and he lives on this life in this flesh, and he understands. It is God's knowledge that gives us strength and encouragement based on the fact that he also has power. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Now it goes into a third element here when it begins to talk about love. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? God has perfect power. He has perfect knowledge. But he also has perfect love. He has the ability. He has the information. And he makes the proper choice. God always makes the proper choice. If you're sick, if you're lonely, if you're emotionally struggling, if you're weak, you can be absolutely guaranteed that God has the power and the information and a perfect ability to make a choice according to love. You can be assured of it. You can hang your hat on that hook, and you know that that is secure. That doesn't necessarily take away your pain, and it doesn't necessarily all of a sudden make life all popsicles and roses, but it does give you peace and assurance. When you can be secure in those things. As it is written, verse 36, for your sake we are killed all day long, we are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. Again, that final attribute. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, angels nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, height or depth, any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. Okay, it's not too hard to portray God's power. And I don't think it's too hard to portray the fact that he has perfect knowledge. How do you portray God's love? I mean, the whole Bible, you're going to read the whole Bible. Services today will be over at 9. And I'll just take some small excerpts from some major books. And how do you portray God's love? The Apostle John wrote epistles, books of the Bible that basically focus on God's love. John 3:16, for God so loved the world, how familiar is that? That he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. I would like to try to portray God's love with some love stories in the Bible. Every story in the Bible has a purpose and a lesson. And there are some phenomenal love stories. And God didn't put them in there just to give us a little bit of human interest. He put them in there for object lessons. He put them in there for a very specific reason. I want to first address the love of Ruth for Naomi, and then ultimately Boaz as well, as in the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 1. I was trying to find a way that I could take stories, some of them are large, the whole book of Ruth, and yet boil it down to the very critical kernel of what was done or said. Joshua judges Ruth. You know, I feel like I must not use my Bible for a month because I'm having to search for some of the books. Ruth chapter 1, verse number 8. This is, at least as much as I can tell, this is the kernel, this is the core that describes Ruth's love, and we ought to be able to take something from that as an illustration of the love of God as well. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in her house of her husband." And she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way. I am too old to have a husband. And if I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband tonight and also should bear sons, would you wait for them until they were grown? Would you restrain yourself from having husbands? No, my daughters, it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Ruth is the example here of a facet, a very strong facet of God's love. She said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." And Ruth said, and how famous is this passage, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. And the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." Ruth to Naomi. Later on, that kind of character and love was directed to Boaz as well. I was trying to find where I had read it recently. I thought it was in the Bible reading program, but I could not find it. There was an emissary from Franklin Roosevelt going to Winston Churchill in England prior to the U.S. entrance into World War II. And Winston Churchill was very concerned, as were the English people, that they would have our support because we had refused to enter into the war at that time. And the emissary, after the meetings they had, quoted to Winston Churchill and to the executives or leaders, whoever was there gathered, and he just got up and answered them, and he says, "Wherever you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. You shall be my people." I didn't say I'll be your God. But he quoted from Ruth saying, "We will be with you. We will send you supplies. We will back you in your efforts to defend yourself. Whatever you do, we will do it by your side." That was his answer. And that was before we entered again into the war. How about the love of Jonathan? Have you ever thought of the love of a love story? All right, man and a woman, right? Well, Ruth and Naomi isn't a man and a woman. It's a love story portraying God's love. The love of Jonathan for David is recorded in a chapter, 1 Samuel 20. I'm not turning to that chapter. I just wanted to... There is a whole passage there where Saul wants to kill David. David knows it. He says, "There is a step between me and death. I am a step ahead of my death." And Jonathan said, "No, not be it. Let it not be so." And David said, "You know, are you faithful? Are you my friend? effectively, "Do you love me?" And Jonathan said, "I do. And I would give myself for you if I could." It's a great chapter. But I tried to find again a verse that describes the love that Jonathan had for David as a love story in a right and proper way. Right? Not the way it's been perverted in our society at times, but in a right and proper way. And look at 2 Samuel. This is where I would use 2 Samuel in chapter 1. This is the verse that I would use to describe that kind of love. After Saul and Jonathan were killed in battle, and David is crying out in verse 25, he says, "How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women." He's not saying that a woman couldn't love as Jonathan had loved. He was saying, "Your love for me, to me, was wonderful, surpassing sexual love, surpassing that sexual bond between a man and a woman." It was a higher form of love in that way that David was describing. It's a great story. It's portrayed very well in chapter 20 of 1 Samuel in terms of how that played out. But it's something that I think, again, if we're going to analyze God's love and try to find things that will picture it in our mind, then I think some of the illustrations in the Bible showing love at a very, very high level are important for us to use. How about the love of the Shulamite for her beloved as it is described in the New King James, which would be the Song of Solomon? Okay, I'll be careful what I read. Isn't it great? You got a book in the Bible, you have to watch, you know, we have to break out into groups before I can read parts of it and describe what it portrays. Song of Solomon, verse number 7, chapter 7. Try to find, again, that portion of the scripture that to me boils down the passion and the love and the elements of a very incredible relation and commitment that are here. Chapter 7, verse number 10. "I am my beloved," the Shulamite here, as it again is written in the New King James, is speaking. This is like, best as I understand, I've heard many different descriptions, the best that I can understand, this is like a play. And it goes back and forth, and the scenes change, and then all of these things play out. And it could have been something that was literal, but it also may have been a story. I couldn't definitively say. But it says, "I am my beloved, and his desire is toward me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the grape has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open, and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits. All manner new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved." She's saying, "I saved myself as a present for you. And when we are together, and when we sexually unite, it is going to be a great rejoicing and a blessing, because I have not been spoiled. I haven't wasted my opportunity." Remember the statement I made last week in the sermon? They asked me at camp, the campers in the tent, I'm the tent parent, they said, "What's the biggest mistake you've ever made in your life?" Well, I'd have to get a pretty long scroll to get them all in one place, but the biggest mistake I ever made in my life is not remaining sexually pure. There's never been a bigger mistake I've made. I haven't turned away from God. That would be worse. And here she's saying, "Come, my beloved, all manner new and old, which I have laid up for you." And it describes it. Now, some of the book is incredibly descriptive. I'd like to think that she reserved holding hands for her husband. I'd like to think, from what this describes, that she reserved even holding hands. And she reserved her first kiss. And I mean a kiss in the sense of more passion as compared to a courtesy or social circumstance that could possibly be different than that. You know, Barbara Hoover was laying in the hospital bed as I went in before or after her surgery, and she was still had just come out of recovery, and I walked in as a first chance I had to see her, and I walked in and I kissed her on the forehead. Wes was right there. It was simply a gesture in a very unusual circumstance in a very difficult time. It wasn't inappropriate, I would hope, by any understanding that I have. But this is different. This is very personal and very close. And then in chapter 8 it goes on, his left hand is under my head, his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love, as one version says, before its time. Don't be out there sharing part of what you are storing up for your mate. Any part of it. Visually or physically. Don't share it. Don't spoil it. Don't cheapen it or throw it away. It will be the biggest mistake you have ever made in this life. And you will have some carriage of that until you go to your grave. I'd like to say, write it all off, it doesn't matter. It's not true. It's not true. Kenny Rogers sang that song, Don't Take Your Love to Town. Well, don't take your love to town. Don't swan it around. Don't show it off. Just save it. Save it like the Shulamite girl here described. And don't awaken love before love is ready to respond. Let it stay a little bit dormant. Let it stay a little bit down. We have a society that says you have to be sexual and you have to have fun and you have to do it now. And it is Satan's way. It is the power of Satan to influence the people who respond to him. I wish I had never responded to him, but maybe in God's grace he has given me the perspective that strengthens me now in the position I am in. All things work together for good if indeed we allow God and recognize his power and his knowledge and his love and mercy on us and using us in that way. God's love for Israel is portrayed, I would say, in Ezekiel 16. But again, it's a whole chapter. But God says, look, you know, I took you. You were a baby that had been cast off. You were still in your blood and laying in the field. And he says, I took you and I washed you and I raised you and I clothed you and I nurtured you. And it's a description of God's love for his people. And he goes on and says, you turned away. You walked away. And I loved you, and I still will finish what it is that I have started. But I think Luke 13, in a much more concise way, portrays maybe God's love. It's in a different part, you know, a whole different context. But Luke 13 and verse number 34. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. Christ says, I love you. I wanted to take you to me. I wanted to hold you in my arms and protect you. And you wouldn't let me. In fact, the men I sent to you or the leaders I sent to you, you killed. You murdered. And I wanted so much just to help you and assist you in this way. So then what do those love stories have in common? We're talking the nature of God in terms of love. What is absolutely fundamental to each of those stories? I'll give you one hint, it's not sexuality. I mentioned before, Ruth and Naomi, Jonathan and David, these are love stories, but it's not sexual love that is being portrayed in all of those circumstances. Obviously, the Song of Solomon does include sexual love. But the standards go beyond that. And the most fundamental element of each of those, I believe, is the level of commitment that is illustrated. What is it in this life we have to do? One thing, learn to put God first. Learn to always put God first and to never turn from it. That is the heart and core of everything we do in this life. What God is showing us through his love is that he has commitment to us. And that we are supposed to be responsive to that, as when a man is in pursuit of relationship to a woman, in that sense he is more forward and she is responsive to that when the time comes. And we are the bride of Christ and we are to be responsive to God. He loved us first. He called us and we responded. I believe the level of commitment that is shown in each of those stories is the most fundamental element that they each hold in common. It's what God was telling Israel over and over again in the Old Testament. I will never leave you nor forsake you. He told Israel that before Moses died. He reminded Joshua of that after he took leadership. You find it again in the book of, Isaiah again. But over and over he says, I will be your God. You will be my people. I will restore you. I will bring you out of your adversity. I will bring you to worship me. I am committed to you. If you know that God has absolute perfect power, and he has absolute perfect knowledge, and that there's never been a misunderstanding, and he has absolutely perfect love, and you are called of God and respond to his service, then that should indeed give us courage, and that should give us peace. That commitment is the fundamental bond, I believe, on which a marriage is built. It's the fundamental bond on which we then turn and raise our children and try, as we might be able to in our service and calling, give them back as heritage we were given back to God. Matthew 28. Notice how this is worded in another context. Matthew 28 and verse number 18. Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. All power, authority. Authority comes obviously with knowledge and understanding. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you, and lo, don't fear, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. I won't leave you, and I won't forsake you. I am powerful, I understand, and I love you, and I do so in a perfect way. Our strength is based, I believe, to a large degree on our character, our knowledge of the character of God. When Frank effectively, those are my words, but when he was saying, he gave me a few different points that he came to, and in my mind, as I processed it, I'm saying, okay, what you came to was a more perfect knowledge of God, and that gave you strength and peace. That's the way I processed. And that's where I began to watch this too, as I was there with Barbara and I was up with Linda. And as Linda's struggling, literally, for life. And I thought, you know, we have to know who God is and how God is in order to put our faith and trust in him. Knowing that he's perfect in power, perfect in knowledge, and perfect in love builds our faith. Gives us the courage to face our trials and, if necessary, even to suffer loss. It gives us a better perspective in this flesh and it keeps our focus on the kingdom to come. And it helps me personally to wonder just a little bit less about whether or not I actually measure up and frankly to be more focused on putting my trust in God.